This podcast is presented to you by a new series, the Clergy Confessions Podcast, now available wherever you get your podcast. Listen to ministers share truly awful experiences in anonymity. In this first season, you will hear stories of a minister fighting for maternity leave deep into her pregnancy, a pastor being fired for discovering an embezzlement scheme by the deacon board, an associate pastor finding his senior pastor and office administrator having an affair on church property, and so much more. Visit clergyconfessions.com. Follow Clergy Confessions on Instagram, Facebook, and whatever Twitter's called now.
You know, every generation has challenges. You can't compare our current experience to past generations as if we can come out with some sort of metric of who had it more difficult, right? You know, our lived experience is enough of a metric unto itself. And our current climate of our culture and politics and religious discourse is fraught with tension and hatred and bigotry and indignation and urgency and apathy. The current climate produces anxiety, and anxiety expresses itself in a lot of different ways, such as fear and depression and anger and loneliness and a myriad of physiological responses. So walk us through how our current climate affects us physiologically and psychologically.
Welcome to the CBF Podcast Conversation. We know that conversations matter, so each week we are grinding through the critical research to bring you the best stories and resources of people doing groundbreaking and innovative work in renewing God's world. I'm Andy Hale, your CBF podcast host, and this year we're celebrating our 7th year of the podcast, bringing you even better interviews worth your time, attention, and collaboration. These episodes are not intended for you to listen to an island unto yourself. Get online, share your insights, thoughts, and feedback from the podcast with us on CBF's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages. We also want you to join the CBF podcast community through our CBF podcast listener support page at cbf.net/podcast support. We see you, Pasadena, California, Louisville, Kentucky, Beaverton, Oregon, and Frankfurt, Germany. First-time listeners and long-time listeners, we are grateful you are here for the conversation. We want to give a special shout out to some of our listener supporters.
The Honorable Charles Qual, Caroline Bell, Cindy Foldenlohr, Trip Hawthorne, Bill Johnson, Carson Fushi, Ralph Stocks, and that generous anonymous donor that keeps giving in honor of CBF Grump. Thanks for listening, Little Rock, Arkansas, Pittsburgh, PA, Ashburn, Virginia, West Yellowstone, Montana, Tamworth, Australia, and Hamilton, Canada. First-time listeners and long-time listeners, we are grateful you are here for the conversation. And before we move on, we need to give a word of gratitude to our annual sponsors, including Zondervan Media Company,
Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work,
Baptist Seminary of Kentucky,
a model ministry,
and Gardner-Webb University's School of Divinity. Finally, and I promise this is it, don't forget to like and share this episode on your favorite social media platforms.
We need to pause to tell you about one of our annual sponsors,
Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity. The Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity aims to equip, nurture, encourage, and support men and women for their best service in the kingdom of God. Offering several programs, including master's and doctoral levels, you'll be equipped and encouraged to discover the unique place where your faith reaches out to meet the needs of the world. Now enrolling for fall of 2023, for more information about Gardner-Webb Divinity Program, scholarships, and grants, call 704-406-3205 and visit gardner-webb.edu. Our guest for this week's CBF podcast conversation is Dr. Shaniqua Walker-Barnes, a clinical psychologist and the professor of practical theology and pastoral care at Columbia Theological Seminary. She's also authored several books, including I Bring the Voice of My People and Too Heavy a Yoke, along with a new book we'll introduce here momentarily. Shaniqua, thank you for joining the conversation.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited about this conversation.
Yeah, so you have such a fascinating journey. You began your career as a clinical research psychologist, you know, even going down the field of getting your master's and PhD in this area, but then you had a sense of calling to ministry. So walk us through that experience.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this story might be familiar to a lot of your female listeners, folks who are in CBF. I actually experienced a call the summer before my freshman year of college. But I grew up in a Black Baptist church here in Atlanta that did not and still does not believe in women in ministry. I had never seen a female minister. I didn't even consider it a possibility for my life, but I knew God was calling me. And I knew God was specifically calling me. At that time, I experienced it as ministering to the needs of African-American families, particularly teenagers. And so I channeled that into a career in psychology. And so trying to look around at the majors and trying to figure out what I could do, what would prepare me and equip me to do the work I thought I was being called to do, I went into that. So after I majored in psychology and African-American, African studies as an undergrad, then went off directly from there to do my graduate work in clinical psychology, began working as a faculty member in clinical psychology. And in that process, actually stumbled into my own self-care journey. And that led me to working with women in my local church on self-care. And it was in the middle of one of our sessions one night when I was teaching about prayer and meditation that I experienced God saying, this is what you're supposed to be doing with your life. And so from that point on, I kind of blew up my psychology career, ended up leaving a tenure track faculty position so that I could go back to school and to go to seminary. And since then, I have been a professor in seminary context, so both Baptist and Presbyterian context.
So it's so fascinating. You've got this academic background and behavioral health, now intersecting with theology and race and gender studies. What does that look like through a course load and helping shape this next generation of ministers?
Yeah, I get to do some fascinating courses. And one of the things I love about being a seminary faculty member is I can think big. Whenever I was in psychology, people always told me I was trying to do too much, take on too much, as opposed to drilling down to like one little variable. But in seminary, in theology, we think God is concerned with all things, right? And so I build a lot of courses. Some of my courses look more like family therapy courses, right? So I have a class on counseling couples in the congregation. Some of my classes are very much geared towards my justice work. So geared towards my justice work, particularly around race and reconciliation. And then some are a nice blending of them. So I do a spiritual care with African-American women. My courses really do touch all the different areas. I have a course on mindfulness and self-care for the helping profession. So it's a little bit of everything, which is one of the reasons I love being a seminary faculty member, and especially the institutions I've taught at have given me a great deal of flexibility and freedom in crafting courses that I think really help people in ministry.
So one of the ways you're doing that is through a new book, Sacred Self-Care. This book is an invitation into nurturing our whole selves through daily practices. You wrote, I want you to challenge yourself, but not make it work for you, but make it work for you, excuse me, and the demands of your life, including any physical or emotional constraints that you have. Just try to do something for your own benefit today. Self-care is one of those words that's used by a lot of different fields. So can you help frame our conversation around the way that you define and envision self-care?
Yeah, so it's interesting because when I started teaching about self-care 20 years ago, there weren't a lot of people talking about it. A lot of times people said, isn't this selfish? People still say that, not to the same extent. But then it sort of became this really popular topic that we were seeing on social media and then eventually in commercials, right? And even the way that when people started talking about it, I kept saying, that's not really what it is, right? A lot of the ways we think about self-care is really consumer oriented, right? So it's about corporations telling us that we need to buy or purchase or travel to something, right, in order to experience self-care. So we need to spend money on the vacation or the cruise or the spa day, right, or a big, shopping spree or something like that. self-care, the way that I think about it and frame it, especially in terms of Christian discipleship, is much more simple. It is the way that we maximize the practices we use to sustain and maximize our wellness. As people who were created in the image of God, I take that very seriously. I think that we ourselves are the first and best gift that we have ever received, and we've received it from God. And we have a responsibility, right? We have a responsibility to honor the gift that has been given to us, not just in terms of how we work out in the world, but also how we treat ourselves, right? How we take care of ourselves mentally, spiritually, physically, emotionally, and even relationally. And so I think about self-care as really being about an approach to maximizing health in a really holistic way.
We can't go any further without telling about one of our annual sponsors, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky. How does your congregation handle ministry staff leadership for areas such as youth and children's ministry? More and more churches are cultivating these leaders from within their congregations. Going away to seminary is not an option for these persons, yet many desire some level of theological education to better prepare them for their ministry role. In response to this trend, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky has launched the Homegrown Initiative. The Homegrown Initiative offers ministry leaders options for training and growth that fits into their busy schedules. If you or someone else at your church is serving as a homegrown minister and is looking to be better equipped as a minister, visit bsk.edu to learn more about new creative options for growth. bsk.edu. That's bsk.edu.
I want to take that thought a little deeper, you know, because self-care can easily, if you're not careful, can get wrapped up into kind of our me-centric world. I want to go back to that latter part of the quote you wrote earlier. Just try to do something for your own benefit today. We live in an egocentric world where almost everything we interact with on a daily basis is centered around our benefits, and just about everything wrong with our world is driven by people's self-interest, right? So how do we know the difference between, I'm going to say, as you phrased it, sacred self-care and another me-centric practice?
Yeah. And it's not always easy to tell the difference. You know, Christians often have a very anti-me perspective. And that's actually rooted in a particularly patriarchal understanding of theology. For women, me-centered isn't actually something that we take for granted. Women and girls tend to be socialized to be much more other-centered. And so because my work started with women and has often centered women, it has often helped people try to experience and develop a healthy sense of self. So one of the things that's different about sacred self-care is we start by understanding what the self is, this idea that we are created in the image of God, and we are created to be in relationship with God, with other people, and with all of creation. And I think that grounds self-care differently, because when I think about self-care, then I'm not just thinking about me and in this sort of hedonistic way. Self-care isn't about pleasure. I think that's one of the things, right? Our popular understanding is that self-care is about pleasure. I am really talking about self-care in terms of health and well-being. And health and well-being very rarely, if we really are about nurturing our health and well-being, that very rarely takes us into being narcissistic, because part of health and one of the dimensions of self-care I talk about is relational. Our relationships with other people are part of our health because we were created to be in relationship, right? God said from the beginning, it's not good for humans to be alone, right? And so this idea that we were created to be in relationship with each other, then part of the thing that I do is I talk about our relationships, making sure that we are giving to and receiving from other people as a way of promoting self-care. And then also, if I'm practicing self-care rightly, I'm actually invested in other people's care, right? I'm not just thinking inwardly. And that was one of the happy accidental lessons that I discovered in my own journey of self-care, that when I began to really tend to my health and well-being, I felt that it opened me up more for relationships to other people and to serve other people, because I wasn't so much in survival mode where I was focusing on everything that I had to get done today, right? I had more of an expansive view of relationships.
So it's important to frame a critical nature of self-care around the enormity of both the times we live in and your personal experience as a two-time breast cancer survivor, an African-American woman in the South, the experience of COVID-19 pandemic and resurgence of white Christian nationalism and an acrimonious political climate. So let's start with you, because your lived experience is a testament to the critical nature of self-care. I wonder if you'll take us a little deeper there.
Yeah. So self-care really is, this is a personal journey. And this book really, I think, tries to encapsulate a 20 plus year journey of trying to practice self-care. It really started because I, you know, right after my 30th birthday, like literally the next Monday after my 30th birthday, I woke up with chronic pain that was very sharp and very unexplained, and began trying to figure out where that pain was coming from. I was in a high stress position at the time, research one, a tenure track faculty member in a psychology department. The department was going through a lot of stuff. And so I really began diving into self-care as a way of trying to cope with the day-to-day stress I was under. And over the years, self-care has been a tool to deal with other forms of stress and trauma. So a breast cancer diagnosis in 2014 helped me to then kind of drill down and say, okay, I need to really, really focus on caring for myself. And then I had a recurrence in 2018 and had just finished treatment and was sort of recovering from treatment when, you know, the world kind of fell apart with COVID-19. And every time that I have experienced one of these setbacks, whether it's something personal or in the case of COVID, white Christian nationalism, we're talking about national and international, I've always known that these are high stress. And one of the things that we need to do, because I carry my stress in my body, so that self-care becomes my tool for dealing with the stress that's in my body. Sometimes the stress that I don't even feel emotionally, because I'm one of those people that, you know, I can be pretty nonplussed, right? And think I'm handling things okay, but then it's in my body. That's where all my anxiety is. It's not necessarily in my head. I might not be thinking about it, but then my blood pressure tells the story or something, right? So for me, self-care is really has become a tool for trying to save my own life, right? As I deal with intergenerational trauma, personal and cultural trauma, and just really trying to survive in a world that is always in some ways chaotic, right? Always under siege. And in a lot of ways, we're taught to kind of hope for calm. And at some point I realized, especially after my second breast cancer diagnosis, I realized there was no calm, right? That was a myth, that actually the problem of evil has been with us since the beginning. The problem of relationship distress, you know, other types of environmental issues have been with this from the beginning. We know this from our own Christian tradition, right? And so I began to realize that part of what we are called to do is to live as well as we can while also trying to make the world a better place, right? It's that combined thing, and that the work that we, especially as people who are called to ministry, we can only sustain that call to the extent that we're caring for ourselves. So yeah, it's very much I'm in this book, I'm speaking to myself. I reread one of the devotional entries this morning and thought, oh yeah, that's right. I need to remember that. So yeah, I think self-care is a lifelong struggle in a lot of ways. And I'm hoping that by writing about it and by bringing other people into the journey with me, it will help me to be better at it.
You know, I say this 100% tongue in cheek, but I can't imagine anything happening in our world and communities that should create such urgency for people of faith to reexamine how they care for themselves on the whole. You know, if it were not obvious, you know, with even just some of the things I was talking about earlier, why is now essential for this conversation?
I think because we are living in a world that, on the one hand, it makes us very self-centered, but it doesn't teach us what to do with ourselves, right? Not in ways that are healthy. It often teaches us to compete with each other or to vie for resources with one another. But care in general is something that's missing from our world. And I really think it's because we don't care for ourselves rightly, right? We care for ourselves in ways that are disconnected from other people, in ways that are disconnected from God and disconnected from the earth. And I think if we learn how to care for ourselves and actually love ourselves well, actually learn how to accept ourselves and be kind to ourselves, then we can accept and be kind to other people, right? I think that, you know, all of, to me, this is rooted in the great commandment, right? That you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your strength, right? And the second commandment being like, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I'm always fascinated by the fact that Jesus assumed self-love, right? He didn't think he had to tell us that was, you're supposed to love yourselves and then you love your neighbor as yourselves. Well, what we're witnessing is a world where we don't love our neighbors, right? The ones who are literally right next door to us, the ones who look differently from us, the ones who are around the globe. And I think part of that is that we really don't know how to love ourselves.
You know, every generation has challenges. You can't compare our current experience to past generations as if we can come out with some sort of metric of who had it more difficult, right? You know, our lived experience is enough of a metric unto itself. And our current climate of our culture and politics and religious discourse is fraught with tension and hatred and bigotry and indignation and urgency and apathy. The current climate produces anxiety, and anxiety expresses itself in a lot of different ways, such as fear and depression and anger and loneliness and a myriad of physiological responses. So walk us through how our current climate affects us physiologically and psychologically.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, let's start with the COVID-19 pandemic, right? At the beginning of it, when we weren't sure what this disease was, how it was being transmitted, but we went into shutdown, we went into quarantine. Quarantine basically was a high anxiety situation. The behaviors we were using on a day-to-day basis to ensure our safety are anxiety behaviors, right? So I would walk in my neighborhood because it was the only way you could get outside was to walk in the neighborhood. But my neighbors and I, whereas we used to talk to each other, we'd see each other coming up the street and we would cross the street, right? We were constantly looking out for who's wearing a mask. Is that person safe? Are they not? Is this 6 feet apart, right? We were washing our grocery bags, right? Wiping down our groceries, the mail, like everything we saw as a potential threat. Anxiety doesn't really stay caged very well. So when you are honing your psyche to be anxious about this one thing, this invisible disease that we didn't know how it worked or where it was, but just that it was killing people, well, that spreads to everything. Because our bodies are, anytime we're anxious, it basically means our stress response is triggered. And we have this really complex stress response that I think is really one of God's miracles, right? Whereas when we are stressed, there's a sequence of about 1500 biochemical responses that get triggered, that get activated in our bodies to make us like stronger, to make us faster. But part of that is something shut down. When we're under stress, so typically if, you know, you're faced with a tiger and you need to run, your body shuts down like reproduction. It shuts down your other parts of your system, your digestion system, right? Because you don't need to be worrying about digesting the food that you ate for breakfast when you're running from a tiger. You don't need to be having sexual urges when you're running from a tiger. So historically, you know, our bodies knew shut down all non-essential functions at this time and divert resources to speed, to strength, to focus, to other things. And then when this threat is over, we're supposed to reset, right? Everything goes back to normal. We live in this age where stress is so unrelenting that we never reset. And our bodies can't actually tell the difference between a threat like a tiger and a threat like I'm having an argument with somebody at work that's making me feel stressed, or I've heard news about the insurrection and that's making me feel stressed. Or I've heard news about somebody being kidnapped or trafficked in the next state over, and that's flaring up my anxiety, right? Our body doesn't make any type of distinction between any of that. And so what is happening is many of us are in this cycle of stress and anxiety all the time that has become normalized in a way in our society. We don't have the language to identify it, and we also don't have the tools to help our system reset when we're experiencing a lot of stress and anxiety about what is going to happen in the world.
We are pausing to tell you about one of our collaborative annual sponsors, A Model Ministry. Are you a church leader who's committed to keeping children safe? If so, then A Model Ministry is for you. We are a registered nonprofit organization specializing in safety education, policy writing, and risk assessment to mitigate child abuse in ministry organizations. We understand that child safety is a top priority for churches, and we are here to create a safe and nurturing environment for all children. Our founders can provide the resources and support needed to implement effective child safety policies and procedures. Visit amodelministry.com to learn more about our services and how we can help keep children safe.
Since 2016, CBF episodes of interviews with authors and practitioners for conversations that matter. These stories of creativity and innovation have garnered weekly support from around the United States and the world. We are inviting you, the listeners, to join us in connecting with the podcast. Become a monthly listener supporter and receive some perks, including name recognition on the podcast, questions for upcoming guests, free books from the podcast, joining the podcast for an interview, and a VIP experience with the General Assembly podcast guest. There are 5 levels of listener support, starting at $5 per month. For less than the cost of a pumpkin spice latte, you will be featured by name on the weekly podcast episode. For more information and to join the community of listener supporters, visit cbf.net/podcast support.
Let's talk about the structure of the book. This is not built around huge chapters with enormous concepts, but 7 weeks or 49 days of a devotional. Why was this approach imperative for what you're trying to accomplish through the book?
Yeah, this really started as one of those things where I wasn't writing a book until I was, right? This started during the pandemic, the first Lent during the pandemic, the full Lent of 2021, where we had been in quarantine for a year, and a lot of people had, to the extent possible, been separated from other people, been isolated from other people. And as we were approaching Lent that year, and I was thinking for myself about giving something up, I realized that this was a year where I didn't feel like giving up was the right thing, that we had already collectively and individually given up a lot. And that it was a year where I thought taking on a nourishing practice might be more helpful. And this is something I've done in Lent's past, but in seeing other people talk about struggle with Lent and what are they going to do, I thought maybe I should invite other people into my practice. And so I began this Instagram challenge, this Lenten challenge in 2021 that was focusing on self-care. We're going to practice self-care for the next 7 weeks or the 6.5 weeks of Lent as a way of learning to love ourselves and also helping us to cope with this moment we find ourselves in addition to COVID-19 pandemic. There was all the racial and social unrest all over the world. So it's just really a high stakes period of time as a presidential election, right? I mean, there's just a lot of stuff happening, the insurrection. So there was a lot. And so I thought this could be an offering to people. Let me just invite them in. And one of the things about Instagram is I can't remember the number of characters, but you only get about maybe I think 200 or 300 characters to write in. And so I had to try to figure out a way to distill practices and lessons about self-care into something that I could put on Instagram. And I found that to be a very helpful writing practice for myself as an academic who likes to write a lot more than that. But to really say, okay, what's the real key thing I want people to get today? And then also, what's a practice? Being a therapist, I know that the way that you foster behavior change is often incrementally, is helping people to try something, experience success with it, and then to keep building upon success. So I thought I'm going to approach this like I would if it was a client, right? Which is, we're going to practice one thing today and see how that works. And then the next day, we're going to add just a little bit more and see how that works. And then the next day, we're going to add just a little bit more. And so what you get in this book is kind of a combination of kind of my personal experience with self-care, but also my understanding as a therapist about how do you deal with resistance? Like, what is the thing that will prevent people from practicing self-care? Let me address those things. How do I make this doable? And I make it where people don't see it and say, this is too much. I can't do this. I can't fit this into my life. And they run the other way. That was also a way of sort of scaffolding these skills so that people felt drawn into them and said, I think I could try that. That won't take me too long. I could do that. And so to make it both meaningful and achievable were real strong aims of mine. And so that's why the book takes the structure it does. I often say it's really a theology of self-care that's written in a devotional format. So people get a chance to try something on, really think about it for a day or so, and then build on it the next day.
I'll be the first to admit that while I love the writings of people like Richard Foster, my temperament does not lean into some of the traditional spiritual disciplines. You know, however, you invite people into the practice of hydrating your body well today. Why is self-care not just these big, fancy spiritual practices like, you know, that require a labyrinth or 30 minutes to Lectio Divina, a random passage?
Yeah. And it's funny because I love Richard Foster's book and other folks, but and I used to teach a spiritual formation class where I would be using this. But I was also teaching at that time for in a predominantly Black seminary where most of my students were bivocational. They were managing ministry with full-time jobs and careers with families, and then they would come into class at night and on the weekends. And so for that population, I mean, yeah, that 30-minute Lectio Divina, it could do to some degree, right? We would use it in class, but then I couldn't get people to go home and do that. And I realized that they needed more. And my background in psychology actually started in health psychology, looking at the interaction between stress and health outcomes, right? And so I was very much interested in the beginning from a very holistic perspective, right? As a psychologist too, I knew that there are lots of people, I've had lots of clients who were very actively involved in church and had strong relationships with God, very strong faith. And that didn't mean their lives weren't in shambles, right? Their lives were still in shambles. And so I wanted to focus more holistically and help clergy, especially like my seminary students, to start thinking about formation as being not just about the spiritual disciplines. Again, we aren't just like these disembodied souls that float around. We're embodied. We experience life through our bodies, right? So there is no separation of our spirit and our embodiment. And so for me, it was always important to think about our formation as being holistic, right? As thinking about, our bodies were created, literally created to need water. But drinking water, I mean, for me, that was something I had to learn to do, but that's insane, right? That I had to learn to drink water and be intentional. To this day, there's a water bottle beside me because I have to be intentional about drinking during the day. But our bodies were created to need water. They were created to need rest. And yet we're always trying to figure out these ways to sort of hack our own biological system so that we don't need the things that we have literally been created to need.
You wrote, sacred self-care is not an act of indulgence. It's an act of resistance. Much like Sabbath keeping, self-care subverts the belief that we must do and be more, that everything must happen now, and that our worth is determined by our titles, our achievements, our productivity, and that we must be the ones who keep the world spinning on its axis. Walk us through why self-care is subversive.
Yeah, I think, you know, we do live in a world that teaches us that our value is based on our productivity. So, you know, you ask people who they are and they'll begin to respond with their jobs or, you know, with their roles to and their relationships to other people. We don't feel that what we do, you know, stay at home moms feel the need to justify why they are stay-at-home moms, right? Like, well, I don't work outside the home. Well, that's okay. You shouldn't feel sorry for that, right? And so there are these ways in which all of us are taught to value ourselves based on our jobs, our educations, our titles. And we're taught that we have to be doing more all the time, especially in today's society. Like if you have a hobby you're good at, then it becomes, well, how do I monetize this, right? How do I turn this into a side hustle? As opposed to, I just like doing this and I'm having fun with it. We have this idea that, you know, the way to success is just by working ourselves really into an early grave for a lot of us. And so to resist that culture that tells us that our worth is dependent on how much we produce is actually is resistance, right? It is a way of saying and really affirming that we are good, right? That we were created, that when God created us, God said, and this is very good, right? And that, okay, we're good. We don't have to prove it. We don't have to, so, you know, kind of faith by works, right? We don't have to do that. That's not to say it catches us, it takes us off the hook for trying to improve our world. I really feel like if we practice good self-care and we are connected to the source being God, we will automatically want to improve the world, but we will also know that that's not our task, that we are not the Messiah. Right? I have a lot of students and clergy friends who I sometimes think they've gotten confused about their role, right? Like it's very tempting and seductive to feel like we are so needed by other people that if we don't step in and do something for them, that their whole lives will fall apart, right? And that's a dangerous place, especially for ministers, for pastors. That's a very dangerous place to get ourselves in. And it's one of the things that puts us at risk for burnout. And we see those headlines all the time about the number of clergy that are quitting, right? The pastor's quiet quitting church, right? We're seeing that all the time. And so part of it is for us to begin to view ourselves as part of God's creation, but not necessarily that we are meant to emulate the sort of martyrdom of Christ.
Let's take a break to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work. What is social work? At Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work, it's empowerment, service, and justice. It's ministry, counseling, and relationship building. It's faith, practice, and community. But above all, it's learning how to help others thrive.
Social workers can be found addressing the full scope of the human experience in churches, schools, prisons, government agencies, senior living centers, nonprofits, and Fortune 500 companies. Careers in social work profession are vast and varied. What is social work, you ask? It's much more than you think. Visit gsswstories.baylor.edu to explore more.
I'm going to come back to the pastor piece. Actually, is my last question. We'll spend a little time there at the end with that. My doctoral dissertation was around organizational psychology for the church, and I love the kind of stuff you write about. However, I realize I'm not the typical minister who might focus on, I'm not a typical minister in the sense of others might focus on other aspects of discipleship. So for someone who may not have a doctoral degree in sociology and cognitive science, how would that kind of pastor begin to shape spiritual formation around this way of thinking about self-care?
I think, you know, one of the things that churches can really do is to do this as a community. I tell my students all the time when I teach them about self-care, and they wonder if this is going to work in a congregational context. And I tell them, take your people with you. Take your people on the self-care journey with you. So teach them the value of caring for themselves. Teach them the value of resting. Have a church Sabbath, right? Okay, that's not going to be Sunday. Or maybe it is. Like, what is the day at the church that you don't have meetings? It's a very simple way to model that in a congregation, right? That there is a day in this church that we are committed to not having meetings, which means all of the church staff get that day off. Everybody who's in leadership, whether it's ordained leadership or your lay leaders, get that day off. What would it look like on Sundays not to have committee meetings, to only worship? We're not doing anything else. We're only going to worship, and then everybody go home. Right. Right. Maybe at most we might do some type of fellowship, but we're not doing it. There's no committee meetings on a Sunday. Right. Or whether it's another day for a congregation. We're not even holding programs on a particular day. I think, you know, the idea of self-care, it isn't actually something that requires a degree. And I try to write about self-care in a way that it is not something you have to be wealthy to experience it. It is something that is the birthright of every one of God's children. And what we need to do then is begin, to the extent that we can, arrange our lives in ways that support our care, and to help encourage each other to care for themselves and one another. I think pastors are actually in some of the best positions to do that, right? You could do it in terms of, okay, we're going to have a church. Now, I know churches that do the Daniel fast together. That's a great way, whether it's that or some other fast, but another way of thinking about health. Churches that have exercise programs that people do. So they're saying, we're not just interested in your spirit. We're interested in all of who you are. All of those are things that churches, I think, have been doing and just can do more of.
This last bit, let's focus on pastors. Pastors are great at helping people. They are not so great at helping themselves. And we now live in a more highly pressurized context of declining church attendance, shrinking budgets, and the expectations of turning this thing around feel firmly placed on ministers' shoulders. So there is more to do with fewer people to do it. And the anxiety of the mindset of, I've poured my life into this vocation, and there's a good chance I'm now going to have to find economic support another way. So how do pastors practice self-care in this environment?
I don't think there's any choice but for pastors to practice self-care in this environment. Otherwise, pastors really run the risk of losing a sense of identity, a sense of mission, a sense of call, and losing their health. You know, as a seminary professor, one of the challenging things that I have found with seminarians over the past 10 or so years is that, you know, they love Jesus, but they don't always love the idea of serving a church. And because they've been watching, younger generations in particular have watched pastors, often the pastors who are their parents, they've watched them sacrifice family, sacrifice health for the sake of ministry. And they struggle with this idea of going into congregational leadership because of the models that they've seen. So I think for one thing, for new generations, we need new models. I don't think it's just the case for pastors. I think it's the case for people in the pews too. They are looking at the pastor's health and vitality and saying, you know, it's not just about the amount of biblical knowledge this person has or their preaching skills, but I'm looking at, can they be an authentic human being? Are they authentically happy and healthy? And that's the type of leader that I want. I think in many ways, the way we have been doing church is often unsustainable and does put too much pressure upon the pastor. And maybe if pastors begin to focus on self-care, not just for themselves, but for all of their staff, people can dream new dreams. You know, it is really hard to dream when you're under stress. That's one of those kind of cognitive capacities that can get shut down. Creativity is hard when you're under stress. But when you're living in a more balanced way, then you can begin to see the problems, right? We have a building that we can't feel anymore. What's a creative way that we can deal with this as opposed to just trying to preserve what we already have? Too often we come at the question of church leadership from a stress and deficit model, right? How are we going to keep the people here? How are we going to protect the space? How are we going to raise the money we need to raise? And sometimes if we are really seriously nurturing ourselves, then we're approaching that question differently, right? We can approach it and say, what other dreams are here? What's the dream that's here that we haven't seen yet? What's that vision that might be bubbling up that we just haven't taken the time to sit down and listen to and hear? What are people's actual needs? What are the needs of clergy? How do we need to pastor differently based on what the world looks like now? I think those are some of the questions that I really would love pastors to begin to entertain. It is a very difficult time to be a pastor, but it is also a time that I think is full of possibility. And people are doing creative things that have never been done before. And no, it's not the same financial structure that churches have had for a long time. But I think if we are really connected to the source, we are really connected to ourselves, we begin to hear new possibilities for doing ministry, new possibilities for living into our call. We begin to get clearer on what our call actually is, as opposed to the sort of hurdles and hoops and infrastructure of our existing congregational and denominational life.
Well, let's maybe end right there. What gives you hope for the future of ministry? You know, I talked about earlier, you are helping shape the next generation of minister, and that's not next generation in a sense of, age base, because we all know that seminary is full of people of a diversity of age. So what gives you hope for the way that ministers are being shaped and prepared now, you know, differently and maybe with a new set of tools than the generations before them?
I am really hopeful about, and really my students give me hope, because again, my students are different ages, races, nationalities, and they love God, they love Christ, they love the church, and they're critical of the church, and yet still in love with the church, right? Still wanting to serve, and they are being so creative. And so It's rare that I have students who kind of come out and say, I just want to be the typical congregational pastor. They have some real clear ideas about what discipleship ought to look like, and they're being tremendously creative. I think some amazing things are happening in the church. We often tell this story, and we look at it from a glass half empty perspective, but there are actually amazing things happening, but they're innovative and they don't look like our typical models of church. And I think if we were to open our eyes to the new thing God is doing in the world, it gives us a lot of hope. It gives me a lot of hope.
Our guest is Dr. Shaniqua Walker-Barnes. The book is Sacred Self-Care. You can stay connected by visiting drshaniqua.com. Shaniqua, it's been a joy being with you. Thank you for challenging us to revisit our understanding and practices around being revived, renewed, and resurrected.
Thank you.
We are grateful for a chance to pause to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Zondervan Media Group.
Explore the depth and beauty of Scripture with the NRSV Updated Edition. With revisions based on new contextual evidence, historical insights, and linguistic precision, this updated edition of the NRSV delivers a translation of Scripture based on meticulous care for accuracy and readability. Learn more about new editions of the NRSV UE from Zondervan at nrsvuebible.com.
Okay, that's it. That's our conversation. If you want more, be sure to subscribe to CBF on all major platforms, including iTunes, Amazon Music, Spotify, SoundCloud, and Google Podcast. Don't forget to like and share this episode on your favorite social media platforms. Be sure to support our annual sponsors by visiting their websites. Again, that's Gardner Webb University School of Divinity, A Model Ministry, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky,
Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work,
and Zondervan Media Company. Check out more at cbf.net for more information about church starters, field personnel, advocacy work, and more. And I'm not sure if we mentioned that you should join the listener support community at cbf.net/podcast support.